This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Welcome to The Informer, Joy 94.9's nightly news and current affairs program, and your link to the stories that matter. We are committed to bringing you the day's most important news and current affairs stories from an LGBTI perspective. If it matters to the LGBTI community, we will cover it. We want to hear from you. Join the conversation, SMS 0427 Joy 949 or email on air at joy.org.au or follow us on Twitter at The Informer Joy.
It's Monday, the 19th of March. Welcome to your nightly news and current affairs show, The Informer. I'm your host, Lara Dickinson. Tonight on the show, we speak to St. George Bank, who have released further findings from their LGBTQI financial wellbeing report. We also pay tribute to the passing of one of Australia's pioneering researchers into HIV/AIDS and a passionate LGBTI health advocate, Scientia Professor David Cooper AO, who passed away on Sunday, age 69, after a short illness.
Within the St. George Bank, we describe ourselves as a family bank, and we care about the financial needs of all Australians. And so over the last few years, we've been looking at ways that we can ensure that our products and services match the needs of different members of our community. And, you know, it's a very diverse range of customers we have. We've done work with seniors, multicultural Australians. But one of the areas we just had no information on was on the LGBTQI community, and we had a lot of our customers that we knew were from part of that community. So we went out and had a look at what research was available in Australia. And to be honest with you, we just couldn't come up with any recent quality information that actually deep dived into the financial wellbeing of this community. So we conducted the research to ensure that we actually had some quality proof points so that we could ensure that we could provide the right products and services. So last year we kicked off a survey of about 1,200 Australians, which included 800 members of the LGBTQI community. We're really proud to be the first Australian financial service provider to do that, but it was so that we would have some really good insights as to what not only were the perceptions, but the needs of that community.
The Westpac-owned bank released its LGBTQI financial wellbeing report last year after the postal survey, which is said to be the first report of its kind for an Australian financial institution. I asked St. George Bank General Manager Ross Miller how and why it was important to get such diverse findings regarding our communities and what this information means. What's really interesting is not just that the data wasn't there for them to find, but that the financial sector didn't really create a need for this data to exist.
Look, I would start by sort of reinforcing that we just didn't know enough about the community. And, you know, we had a lot of anecdotal evidence from, you know, customers we spoke to one-on-one. But that's why the research has been really instrumental in providing some quality proof points to help us better understand if there are different financial needs or circumstances. One of the early things that I took out of the research is that there are a lot of perceptions that the financial services industry in Australia isn't currently providing the right services for the LGBTQI community. What we're doing now is actually checking whether they are perceptions or reality and testing that with our products and services and even the way that we have quality needs-based conversations with our customers in branch.
2017 was an interesting time for LGBTIQA plus Australians, with the postal vote creating greater stress and anxiety as the validity of our lives was put to a public vote, which is why the timing of this survey and data is so interesting. I asked Miller if the postal vote played a factor on the need for the information or its possible outcome.
Look, there's no doubt it was a historic and important year for Australia as they voted on such an important topic. Interestingly, we kicked off our research well before even the announcement of the vote. And we actually also made a very, very conscious decision to release our research a little bit early, ahead of the vote, to actually demonstrate St. George Bank totally was committed and supported this community. We didn't need to see the outcome of the vote. We wanted our customers and Australians to know that as a family bank and as a diverse and inclusive bank, that we were really keen to share these findings and see that, you know, One Australian Bank was certainly setting the way in actually making sure it understood the needs of this community.
Researching the financial needs of our community is not an easy one, Gay and lesbian financial needs do not correlate to each other necessarily. Neither do that of trans nor intersex people. Don't worry, we're going to get onto the differences in the data for our communities in just a minute. But what is very interesting is to find out where our communities are similar when looking at the results.
A couple of things that I don't think anyone listening will be surprised to hear. Almost the entire community agree that they should have the same rights as everyone else. But within that, about 90% of the respondents indicated that they did feel that life was harder for them compared to heterosexual Australians. I think along those lines, about 85% of the respondents actually indicated that they believed financial products were designed for traditional relationships. Now, we're hoping in St George that's more perception than reality, but gives us a really good guide on the way that we ensure we have the right conversations with our customers to ensure that we're testing their needs and being open to the financial wellbeing challenges that they have. Another interesting point was around where the community lived, and we found that predominantly the community was based in metro areas, nearly 70%, and that they also indicated that there are only some communities that they'd be prepared to live in, 75%. And as we understand, that's far greater than heterosexual counterparts.
Is our disposable income a misconception many people have about us? Since we don't have children, we have more money to spend. Is there a pink dollar to grab a hold of, or does this data suggest that that's actually a myth?
If we look at spending as a category, and we ask similar questions in all the types of surveys we do, for all groups within this community, with the exception of trans, the number one major expense that was indicated was holidays. Now, for trans, just to give you an indication of how it was different, that was for major out-of-pocket medical expenses. But again, if we look at that research and compare it to the majority of the community in hetero Australians, we found that we had the three same top priorities, those being holidays, buying a new car, or buying a property, all in that top three. That said, within the community, as you indicated, it's much less likely than hetero Australians to incur major expenses related to children, such as school fees. However, one group within the LGBTQI women, they were five times more likely to incur major expenses on IVF or reproduction-related services.
Last week, St George released specific data in relation to women who have sex with women from the survey. And although the gender pay gap within the LGBTIQA plus community is smaller than in the straight community in Australia, that it even exists shows that the gender pay gap is not just related to women taking on a disproportionate share of domestic care or labour. It indicates the strength that the effect that underrepresentation has had for women in the workforce. It shows that this problem is symptomatic as well as social, which means this is a problem for governments and organisations to really look at, because they could play a part in fixing it by changing the system they work within, making it better for us all.
The interesting thing is the research shows that the good news is the pay gap between women and men is smaller in the LGBTQI community than their hetero counterparts. However, there still is a gap. And so we found that of the LGBTQI women surveyed, they earn approximately 18% less than LGBTQI men, whereas hetero women earn 31% less than hetero men, according not only to our research, but broader research that's been conducted. Probably not surprisingly, the superannuation gap, though, is smaller for LGBTQI women. And we could make the assumption that that is related to the fact that less of that community have actually taken time away from work with children. The findings also show that LGBTQI women are five times more likely to incur expenses related to IVF or reproduction-related services than hetero women. And they're also less likely to become a home owner-occupier and less likely to benefit from shared expenditure in retirement. Now, these are early findings that we do want to carefully consider. Again, coming back to the fact that, are we having the right conversations with these members of the community at the right time to ensure that they're considering their financial well-being into the future years, including retirement? 63% of people surveyed say they're worried about their ability to financially provide for themselves and their family in the future.
I asked Miller if these findings were just in relation to lesbian women, because the needs of trans and intersex or gender diverse women add an additional cost on another level.
The way that we've asked the questions, the survey results relate to all women within the survey that have responded. There are some pieces, as you say, that there's greater expenditure for different groups, and people have called that out. You know, there's no doubt that, particularly if we look at transgender Australians, they came across as a more disadvantaged group, with 9 in every 10 saying they felt particularly vulnerable and worried about providing for themselves and their family. They were less likely to be in the workforce and more than twice as likely than the LGBTQI average to be unemployed or looking for work. So, you know, there are some particular challenges with that group that, again, give us great insight in the way that we can have wholesome and supportive conversations with customers that identify as trans in branch.
So what now? We know that something needs to change. How can things be different? Miller explains what's next for St George.
There's a couple of things that we can do immediately. It's really important, and I'm very, very privileged to be the leader of a great Australian organisation that wants to do the right thing by its customers. Firstly, awareness is the biggest step change for us. We're able to provide the results of our survey with our people, and also from that, be able to provide them with the skills and capability to have the right conversations with our customers. We do believe that there is an opportunity for us to become the first Australian bank that actually will allow customers to choose on the system how they're identified, particularly when it comes to trans, and that we can ensure that we're always having the right conversations with those customers. So it's about implementing stronger service standards and training regarding equality, changing our branch technology so that we can have a customer's gender identity placed on their banking profile. But also, really importantly, the reason we're doing some PR around this, the reason that we're talking about this at a public level, is encouraging members of the LGBTQI community to come into, in our case, St George, for a financial health check, so we can help relieve of some of the financial concerns that they're expressing in the survey. We also want to use the opportunity to learn from where there is a perception that with their hetero counterparts, where they believe traditional relationships get a higher standard of service from financial institutions, we can demonstrate that's not the case. But also there's an emerging trend for planning for families, and even more recently with the great news around marriage equality, planning for a wedding and the costs associated with that.
That was DNR Curie speaking to the General Manager of St George Bank, Ross Miller, about their findings of the LGBTQI Financial Wellbeing Report, following the Australian Council of Trade Union last week calling for a 7.2% increase to minimum and award wages. With 60% of women and 52% of men in the LGBTQI communities earning less than $40,000 per year, this increase would be a significant increase in wages for many LGBTQI Australians. Although last year's report from St George's Bank showed that the LGBTQI community in Australia does, on average, earn 25% more than their straight counterparts, it also outlined that the financial cost for this community that will negate those higher earnings. Most LGBTQI individuals are a third less likely to own their own homes, and those who have managed to enter the property market have a mortgage 41% higher than the straight individuals surveyed. Plus, there's further financial strains of the expensive medical procedures for many in the trans communities and high assisted reproduction costs for most LGBTQI individuals hoping to have children.
This is The Informer, Joy's nightly news and current affairs program. We want to hear from you. Join the conversation, SMS us on 0427 Joy 949, email on air at joy.org.au, or add us on Twitter at The Informer Joy.
Global pioneer of research into HIV, Professor David Cooper, passed away on Sunday, aged 69, after a short illness. Professor Cooper initiated groundbreaking research into the infectious disease and was one of the first to respond to the worldwide AIDS epidemic in the early 1980s. We pay tribute to him with the following audio collected from conversations he's had over the past few years, as well as with a tribute from the president of ACON, Justin Coonan, who pays his respects.
So it was 1981. I got to Boston in August. The first papers in the New England Journal were in the middle of that year. And it was absolutely fascinating because there was an immunodeficiency disorder of adults, which seemed really quite extraordinary. And so that was, you know, I just became involved at that stage, and I realised that when I came back to Australia, it may well be a problem, because I went back to my original hospital where I trained, at St Vincent's Hospital in Sydney, which was an inner city teaching hospital. And with the geography of Sydney, the hospital is on one side is the gay community, and on the other side is the sort of King's Cross sex, drugs, rock and roll, right? And so I thought, well, if it's going to be a problem in any hospital in Australia, it would have to be at my institution. And And that's what happens. That's where we saw the first cases, where we actually saw the seroconversion illness. We actually described it and published the seroconversion illness in The Lancet in 1985, when in fact there were very hardly any cases of AIDS in Australia at that time. So the virus was just being introduced into the gay community in Sydney.
David was a giant in the field, and we're going to miss him terribly, both for his tremendous intellect and for his huge compassionate heart.
But it was difficult, and you know, in the peak year, which would have been 92, 93, I would have had a ward of about 36 people, you know, continuously, quite very, very sick and dying and really difficult. And it was a very, very stressful time for me. In the end, I just couldn't even face going to funerals. It was just so horrible, you know.
David's worked on HIV for over 30 years. And during that period, we've seen HIV and AIDS transform from a near-certain death sentence to a chronic, manageable condition, which can be controlled by taking a pill a day.
And so I was able to apply my, you know, clinical skills and investigation in the laboratory to sort of define that that first phase of the infection. And, of course, that's become now absolutely critical in cure research because... that's the time at which maybe the reservoirs are not laid down in large amount, and therefore that might be the time to, you know, to intervene and produce a cure, as for example in the Mississippi baby.
There are thousands of people who are alive thanks to the work of David Cooper, and we've worked with him up until recent times, including through the implementation of EPIC New South Wales, which is probably the world's largest clinical trial of pre-exposure prophylaxis or PrEP.
So in 1994, it was Yokohama. I was involved in Yokohama in the organisation. I thought it was important because it was actually in our region. It was the first conference that was in Asia Pacific, and you know, being someone that comes from that part of the world, that was important. And you know, I still think that concentrated epidemics in Asia Pacific are a real challenge. So I was involved in the meeting and I supported the meeting, but it was the pits because, you know, the Concord result had come out in Berlin, and to generate any enthusiasm 1 year later was really very, very difficult. What I didn't realise was what a minimal organisation that it was. It was essentially a site selection committee for the World AIDS conferences. It had a membership which was pretty low and not terribly influential. And it didn't have much money in the bank. It had about, I think, $50,000 in a bank account in Hamburg. So it wasn't a good base to start the International AIDS Society. So together with Lars Callings, who became Secretary General at Yokohama, we sort of set about trying to rather than to, you know, to be a big advocacy organisation, just to try and get the grassroots together, to try and get it as a international organisation that had some roots, to try and get some finance, and to, you know, try and generate some interest, and to also try to say to the international community, IAS needs to be not just the site selection committee, but needs to be the people who take responsibility for these conferences. And that didn't happen immediately. You know, the Canadians had already decided about doing Vancouver, and so it took quite a while for, you know, for that transformation to occur. But we did set in place the tools to allow it to happen.
His legacy will live on, but we'll miss him terribly.
So obviously it was a huge euphoria at that meeting. You know, I Julio Montana, who's, you know, one of the other past presidents, you know, had put was spoke about the INCA study, which was one of the, you know, the really important combination therapy studies, in this case using a non-nucleoside, not a protease inhibitor, but that was very important. And that was a study that Joep Langer and Julio and myself had actually designed together, you know. So that was very exciting, and to just see the field sort of transform before your eyes was really, you know, great compared to the misery, if you like, of Yokohama. So that was a really, really very good feeling. The provision of antiretrovirals post Vancouver was, you know, was a really big issue. We managed it pretty well in rich countries, you know, who could afford to pay the money, and you know, we saw the Lazarus effect, right? The wards just emptied out, and that was a huge relief. I think we didn't go very rapidly from 96 to 2000 to realise the plight of the of low and middle income countries. For me, I think the biggest thing right now is, you know, how do we optimise the rollout? We've got more and more people to treat, and we have to work out how to do more with less money, or more with at least the same money. And for me, that's what's really exciting. What are the ways in which we can provide clinical science evidence for doing things more efficiently, more effectively, more cost effectively? The cure issue is a complex one. I think the science is really important to work on that. I'm not sure that it's ready for, you know, putting potentially toxic drugs into people. And particularly when we have such effective antiviral drugs, you know. So and one of the other things that I think suffers in that is vaccine research. At the end of the day, I don't think antiretroviral therapy, as good as it is sustainable for life of a person. I'm not sure whether we'll eliminate HIV with test and treat. Haven't done that for tuberculosis. We've never done that for syphilis, so I'm not sure. And they're curable diseases, right? So I think that, you know, we have to be careful that we don't move to the next most exciting thing. And at the end of the day, I think a vaccine is the one way that will be a sustainable preventive strategy. That vaccines are the best things to prevent infectious diseases. As much as I've been involved in antiretroviral therapy, as fascinating as it's been, as the fact that I've been involved in every drug that's been developed at some level, whether it's phase one or phase three or whatever, and each one of those drugs has a personality of its own, as much as I think it's been a modern medical miracle, I think, yes, it'll be a mainstay of the way we approach the epidemic. I think the treatment as prevention has been a big advance to protect other people. But I still think that a vaccine is, at the end of the day, is the way to go. And we mustn't lose that momentum, as difficult as that is. Right?
David was a giant in the field, and we're going to miss him terribly, both for his tremendous intellect and for his huge compassionate heart. David's worked on HIV for over 30 years, and during that period, we've seen HIV and AIDS transform from a near-certain death sentence to a chronic, manageable condition, which can be controlled by taking a pill a day. There are thousands of people who are alive thanks to the work of David Cooper, and we've worked with him up until recent times, including through the implementation of EPIC New South Wales, which is probably the world's largest clinical trial of pre-exposure prophylaxis or PrEP. His legacy will live on, but we'll miss him terribly.
That was the president of ACON, Justin Coonan, paying tribute to the passing of one of Australia's pioneering researchers into HIV/AIDS and a passionate LGBTI health advocate, Professor David Cooper.
This is The Informer, Joy 94.9's nightly news and current affairs program, and your link to the stories that matter.
After hearing the speech of Olympic figure skater Adam Rippon last week, where he discussed how he was afraid that he wouldn't be welcomed by the LGBTQ community because someone like him wouldn't be the role model that the community was looking for, it got us at The Informer thinking. Were any of you freaked out because you wouldn't be accepted or welcomed by the LGBTIQ community before you came out of the closet? Or maybe do you feel this way now? If so, we want to hear from you, because our diversity is our strength and our inclusivity is what makes us a stronger, more accepting community. We aren't just a voice for the parts of our community that speak the loudest or the longest. We all have something to say. If you'd like to share who you are or how you feel with us here on The Informer, then get in touch at theinformer@joy.org.au or via our Facebook or Twitter and help us show how our differences make us a stronger community.
There is still more to come on Joy's The Informer, the news program from an LGBTI perspective.
That's it for another episode of The Informer, bringing news and current affairs for Australia's LGBTI communities. Don't forget to follow us on social media at The Informer on Joy 94.9 on Facebook and at The Informer Joy on Twitter. If you have a story or tip you'd like to share with us, get in touch at theinformer@joy.org.au.
This is The Informer, Joy 94.9's nightly news and current affairs program, and your link to the stories that matter.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.